Welcome to the new Health Club podcast. Our now has changed forever. The new Health Club is where the conversation around the new era of mental health, mental wellness, and this now, the new now, begins. I think that psychedelics will play a big part in this. We are talking about a completely new lifestyle here. So what are LSD, magic mushrooms, psilocybin and MDMA or ketamine exactly doing for our mental health, personal progress and optimization? Will they change our lifestyles forever? Will they be a big part of this new normal? On the New Health Club podcast, I talk to real innovators, thought leaders and disruptors from the emerging new world of psychedelics, mental health, and mental wellness. Please enjoy. This podcast deals with drugs. Drugs are dangerous. Furthermore, the use and or trade of drugs can be punishable by law. Please keep this in mind. This podcast is not suitable for people under the age of 18. Hi everyone, and welcome to a new episode of the New Health Club podcast. Today with the amazing Ayelet Waldman, who I think is a great writer and a great talker, thinker, and founder, as we learn later. Ayelet is an Israeli-American novelist and essayist. She's written many novels, TV shows like Unbelievable on Netflix, and the book A Really Good Day. Her fascinating diary on her microdosing experiment with LSD. A tool that could become relevant for difficult times like the one we're experiencing now. Ayelet describes herself as a basic bitch in yoga pants, sipping caramel latte, and she's not your usual psychedelic customer, aka tech dudas, or not a spiritual woo-woo person, as she says. Which makes her book even more interesting. Ayelet took the idea of microdosing LSD into the mainstream with her book, and she asks how this could work on a daily basis for everyone. She's also just founded a nonprofit organization, Feed ER, which started with a lunch and a plea to support local businesses, but is now raising money to feed health workers in the Oakland area, and is just raising money to support people working very hard in the current situation. And if you want to know more about this, we will have some info in our newsletter, which you can subscribe to under www.thenewhealthclub.de. And now on to the fantastic Ayelet Waldman. So, of course, it would be great if you first introduce yourself. And I'm very, very lucky to have you on the show because you have a lot of things to do in life.
Yes, following this craziness that I've got going on.
Yeah.
It's been madness. I've never worked so hard in my life.
Okay,
been so busy.
But I mean, so you're a writer. You're also a professor at Berkeley?
No.
Not anymore?
I'm a writer. A novelist. I write also nonfiction. My last book that we're going to talk about today is called A Really Good Day, and mm-hmm. It's a nonfiction book.
Yeah.
I also run television shows. My last two shows were Unbelievable on Netflix, and I was a co-executive producer of Star Trek Picard, which you can see on Amazon mm-hmm. in Germany. Mm-hmm. And then over the past week, I have become the head of a nonprofit delivering restaurants that we purchase at full price from local delivering meals, not restaurants, that we purchase full price from local restaurants to keep them in business and deliver to the hospitals, to the emergency rooms and the intensive care units to mm-hmm. keep them nourished and keep them from having to eat out of vending machines and sustain them in this very difficult time. Mm-hmm. So that's what's taking up my time nowadays.
Okay. But I mean, it's interesting because I feel this seems like already like a really interesting tool to kind of create, to face this time, actually, to create something that immediately helps other people.
Absolutely. You know, because I have a mood disorder, which I write about a lot in A Really Good Day, this kind of thing puts me at risk. You know, I mean, I could have just crawled into bed and not gotten out, and it would have been it would not have been surprising given my history of cycling in and out of depression. So this thing, which we're calling East Bay, which is the name of the area we live in, Feed ER, but one word, feeder. Mm-hmm. This thing has really made it possible for me to, you know, I have to get up every morning.
Yeah.
I have to get up and mm-hmm. I have to just get on Slack and get to work. And I have to go out and do deliveries. Now we have a whole delivery team.
Okay. Wow.
I have to, you know, do a bunch of Zoom calls. And so it just keeps me moving, 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 which for me is really important for my state of mind. Mm-hmm. If I'm not moving it every minute, I start to get depressed.
Okay.
So this has been really helpful.
That's in general, that seems to be a very, very good tool for a lot of people to just think of something that they could give to another person that they kind of can give freely, or it's not a big deal for them.
Right.
So, which because
I think that's true. I think everyone has to, I mean, it's, you know, we have this like three prong value statement for this. We realize that a value statement really helps when you start something like this. Mm-hmm. And so our value statement is to nourish our community by nourishing our frontline hospital staff, sustaining our local residents. And also in this third part, I didn't even think about when we began, but it is nourishing our community as a whole by giving them a way to contribute. And mm-hmm. I think that's actually a really important piece of this, because people need to be able to participate in something positive while they're going through something as challenging as this. And, you know, even if it's just giving $10, you feel like you're there and you're showing up and you're helping. And that's been huge for people.
So, I mean, is that your coffee?
Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
He has really kept my 18-year-old sane. She's, Michael and I started the thing where we'll give you a book if you give us N95 masks. Because,
Wow.
It's so hard to believe this, and you will not be able to believe this coming from the country you come in that has a working healthcare system, but we don't have personal protective equipment for our medical staff. So our frontline medical staff is utterly unprotected when they're dealing with people with the disease. They're reusing masks all day long, sometimes more than a day. Mm-hmm. They're using regular hospital masks when they should be using the ones with the respirator.
Yeah.
It's madness. So people in California, at least, often have respirator masks in their earthquake kits. So we've been begging people to pull them out of their earthquake kits, give them to us, and we'll bring them to the hospital. So I've got my teenager, my 18-year-old, doing those mask pickups and drop-offs. And that's been really good for her, too, to have this sense of, like, I'm participating, I'm contributing. Mm-hmm. So.
So basically the family could become a company overnight. A little bit.
I hope not. I honestly, when this is over, I just want to go back to work.
No, sure.
I just want to like be in my quiet zone. But you know, maybe this will help us get through this. Maybe it will help. I think it will.
Absolutely.
We have my niece and nephew were diagnosed with, they were remarkably got a test, which doesn't usually happen here because we also don't have any testing because mm-hmm. we refuse to use the World Health Organization testing kits, and our incompetent Center for Disease Control created a test that didn't work. So we don't have any testing. There's very little. You can only get tested if you're basically at death's door mm-hmm. or if you're a medical professional. And even then, there are lots of medical professionals who haven't been able to get a test. So in some hot spots, you can get them, very few. So my niece and nephew managed to get a test and are both sick. Mm-hmm. But luckily they're on the mend because, you know, they're young, they're in their early 30s. So we really need distraction around here.
Yeah. But I mean, let's jump right into your famous book because, I mean, you were the first, you could say, I mean, person who wrote about this, which I like a lot from a very personal point of view, that you just tried microdosing without waiting for another 5 years until there will be some studies
right.
that are actually already there, but maybe not. I mean, it will take a while until this is like completely decriminalized and everything. But so,
right.
So walk us through the experience. So the thing is you come to this point in your life where you realize, okay, nothing kind of works anymore. And you tried a lot
right.
of things and you have a great support system, but you're in this day when you realize, okay, either I do this or nothing else will work anymore. So just talk a little bit about that moment, maybe.
So it was very, it was really desperate, I think is the right way to put it. I, you know, like I said, I have a mood disorder and I have something called premenstrual dysphoric disorder. Well, at least until I stopped menstruating. And what that meant, it was basically like PMS, but on steroids, right? So I would crash really hard in the week before my period, and it would catalyze a depression and irritability, which meant I was basically yelling and screaming at people, which is terrible. And what ended up happening was I got this treatment that was really effective, which was you take a little bit of an SSRI right before that depression hits, and it works like magic. It works actually within, because it acts on progesterone, it works within 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. Amazing. So I could start to feel, and I got really good at feeling when the wave was coming and nipping it in the bud. But the thing about that is you have to know the wave is coming, and you have to be able to calendar it. You know, you have to have like a period calendar. And when you hit perimenopause, that period, those years or months before, it's usually years before you go into menopause, your system goes all out of whack. Your schedule goes all out of whack. Sometimes you get three periods a month. Sometimes you don't get a period for 3 months. And I couldn't predict with any accuracy when the depression was going to come. It would come out of nowhere. So things were getting worse and worse. And other medications had just never worked for me in the same way that they were supposed to. You know, a doctor would prescribe an SSRI like Zoloft or Celexa or, you know, Effexor. I mean, I could list them forever, the ones I was on. And I would get fat, and I'd lose my sex drive, and I wouldn't feel any better. So I was just sort of like, you know, scrambling for something, because I just got more and more depressed, and my suicidal ideation, you know, thinking about suicide, got sort of, it became like the constant echo in the back of my head. Like anytime I wasn't thinking about something else, I was thinking about killing myself, which not good. So I, when you're a writer, you get a lot of books, they sort of show up in your house. And one day, this book about being a psychedelic explorer, the Psychedelic Explorer's Guide, showed up at my house. And I did not look at it. I mean, who cares? Whatever. I'm not an explorer of any shape or form. I just was like, you know, and the whole thing seemed really hippy-dippy to me. I'd never taken psychedelics except one sort of aborted attempt in college. So I just paid no attention, like zero attention. And then I opened it for some reason in this period of real despair, which the woo-woo people will tell you that, like, the medicine called to me. I don't know.
It did.
I don't know if I believe in that thing, but it kind of did. Yeah. I hate to admit it, but it kind of did.
It's good.
And then I read this chapter about microdosing. Oh, my God. This sounds incredible. And then I started Googling, and there was this YouTube video where this woman said, described the experiences. Well, I just had a really good day. And I thought,
that's what you need.
That's what I want. I haven't had a really good day in as long as I can remember. So I actually reached out to Jim Fadiman, the guy who wrote the Psychedelic Explorer's Guide. I called him on the phone, which was kind of crazy. And he was totally willing to talk to me and very supportive. And he was loving in this way that I'd never really experienced before. I do not have a loving father. I'm always searching for male, like, father figures, which I didn't even realize until, like, I wrote this book that was the constant sort of story
interesting.
Of my life.
Wow.
Yeah, I didn't know that that's what I was doing. I just thought and I'm always writing about it too. In all my novels, there's like an elderly man who becomes loving and supportive. It's so crazy. Like, you know, I didn't even know I was doing it. So the last time in Love and Treasure, my husband was like, well, there he is. There's the guy. And I'm like, what? So it's really quite hilarious. So I am, you know, one was a violinist and one, I mean, it's just really very funny.
Okay. And James told you what to do, basically.
He went right into that role. And I realized it's because, and I really do believe this, because he has so much experience with psychedelics and has done it so much and has been digging so deep into his own psyche, he has this kind of almost otherworldly generosity and capacity for love and connection. And look, I am the last person, like, I am so practical. For me to be saying these things, you have to believe me, because I would never have believed that. But, you know, I really do believe that being able, having spent a lifetime confronting the reality of an interconnected world has made him this incredibly loving, supportive person. So he said to me, basically, try it. Nothing, you know, nothing can happen to you. So I searched and searched and searched. You would think I would be able to find a little bit of LSD because I live in the Bay Area, California. Yeah. But as my kids say, I'm a real basic bitch, you know, like I drink my lattes with vanilla syrup and I wear yoga pants and like, who am I to, like, I didn't have any LSD connects. I was invited to the first Burning Man and I was like, ew, that sounds terrible. So, that's who I am. But in the end, I went out to my mailbox one day and opened the mailbox, and there in the mailbox, in a little beautiful package with lots of like old American stamps, was this, when I opened it up, there was a little blue vial and a poem. And, it basically was, you know, it said, this is 5 microgram, 1 drop is 5 micrograms. Mm-hmm. And I thought I'm like, I'm not an idiot. And I just drink it. I tested it. You buy LSD testing kits on Amazon. Mm-hmm. Can you believe that? Anyway,
and psilocybin, psilocybin,
all sorts of things.
Productions. Yeah. Okay.
Who knew that that Amazon would become the dark web? So I ended up, doing it. And at first I was like, well, this didn't do anything. I took the drops in the morning. I was like, I went to work doing my normal work. And then I lifted my head one and I looked out the window and I have a dogwood tree in my yard, which bursts into bloom in the sun, in the springtime. And the dogwood tree was in bloom. And it wasn't like, you know, flowers or, you know, taking flight, but I just looked and I thought, oh, look how beautiful the dogwood is. And the thing about that was that during this period of depression, I had become all but anhedonic. I could not appreciate beauty. And there was beauty. And I could see it. And I could enjoy it. And it was incredible. So for me, the depression ended that moment. Mm-hmm. Unheard of. It was just gone. And it wasn't like every day was an amazing day, but it was, mm-hmm, for the period of time that I was microdosing. I had many more really good days than really bad days. I had a kind of easeful contentment. Like I could just chill, you know, and I had the capacity to focus on the kinds of therapies that make a difference when you have a mood disorder, like dialectical behavioral therapy, which is a kind of therapy that takes a tremendous amount of reflection and, mm-hmm, focus. And I wouldn't do it before. I just didn't have that space in my head for reflection and focus. And the microdosing gave me that space in my head so that when I ultimately stopped doing it, I had already developed the habit and the pattern, which was really key. So people often ask me, oh, does the microdosing work after you stop doing it? No. Chemically, no. Mm-hmm. But the way it helped me to grow and change has in many ways sustained itself.
Mm. And I mean, you also write in a book when you at a dinner party, you kind of try to talk to friends about it and they changed the subject pretty quickly.
Yeah, so. It was an older couple that had, okay, a long drug history.
Oh, really?
They got very intense about, okay, it. Yeah, I found out later from their daughter. But the thing is, now they're like so down because lots of people were talking about microdosing before, but in a very specific way, like in a very, you know, in the kind of tech bro, make, mm-hmm, yourself, yeah, smarter, faster, sure, way, or in the kind of psychedelic way. And like I said, basic bitch, right? So I kind of mainstreamed the practice. My book made it possible for testing to start in a way that it hadn't before. And for people who are like me, sort of typical average humans, to say, oh, I'm going to give this a shot. Old people, young people. And it's become really mainstream. So mainstreamed, in fact, that I am developing a half-hour television show based on the experience, which was at first at Showtime, and now we're moving. But it's like a dramedy, you know, so it's partly, it's funny, it's serious. So it's really kind of amazing that that's happened. And I feel really good about that. I feel really good about having been part of... What is my dog doing? What are you doing? I feel really happy about and proud of having been part of the wave that is making this more mainstream. And because I really believe that it's a way for people to take control of their own mental health. You know, we're so used to just saying, okay, I'll take this pill, I'll do this treatment. And the thing is, sometimes they work, but a lot of times they don't. And people are always saying to me, you don't know what psilocybin or LSD does to the brain. You know what we don't know what does to the brain either?
All the other things.
We don't know what SSRIs do to the brain. Mm. We don't do... Like, they give you a medication that's designed to help people who have seizures, and they say this helps your mood disorder. Sometimes it really does. But like, what is that doing in my head? I don't know. Yeah. Nobody knows. We don't have any idea what the results of an international mass study on the long-term use of psychedelics will be. Who knows what the fuck we're going to find? Sorry, what the fuck we're going to find out in 10 years? In 20 years about people who use psychedelics for 50, 60 years? I don't know.
Yeah, no,
I'm
exactly.
Not psychedelics.
SSRIs, like, you mean? Yeah.
Well, that's also true, but we don't know what's going to. We do know what's going to happen in 50 or 60 years with people who have used psychedelics because we've done that, but we don't know what's going to happen with people who use Prozac. Mm-hmm. So psychedelics, nothing. Turns out nothing happens for 50, 60 years of use. In fact, maybe it's actually enhances your neurological connectivity.
It really does. I mean, I've done this psilocybin treatment in Amsterdam at Synthesis, and I came home and somebody was like, "What do you know all these names, Sandy?" Like in 2 seconds.
Really?
Because everything came back.
Faster.
Like it does, which is a great thing.
I've noticed since I stopped doing it that I'm losing that. It was very nice for me. Like, I have a terrible memory, which is really hard when you're a writer, I gotta say. But when I know it's really a problem, but during that period, my memory was so much more. I was faster. I was quicker at things, which was pretty damn exciting, I gotta say.
But I mean, I feel now in the situation we are right now, I mean, it almost kind of makes sense that, let's say, if people could microdose now, if it would be possible, it would actually make everything more kind of less panicky, and people could actually think maybe rather about real solutions for their communities than just freaking, like plain... freaking.
Hey, look, kinda. I don't know, but maybe. Like, I certainly know that part of what I'm doing now is not, it's not unrelated to the experience I had. Look, every experience makes you who you are. But like, you know, right now I am able to focus on my therapies, and I know it helps me, and I would not have been here if it hadn't been for the microdosing. So for me personally, in a very real way, all the things that I'm doing now during this crisis and the way that I'm maintaining my stability are absolutely connected to my microdosing experience. But I don't know if that's true for everybody, but for me personally, yes. And do you feel like it's true for you with your psilocybin experience?
Yeah, totally. I mean, because I think, I mean, I was kind of, I did an LSD experience last year in May, and a guided experience and a psilocybin experience. And I would totally say that these two experiences, first of all, they solved a lot of weird things that I thought I could never solve. Or they led me on the way, let's put it that way. And then the second thing is they made me found this company. I just totally know it. It's not a big let me think about it. So it really
you know what it
yeah,
made you
totally,
do.
Exactly. But I mean, do you think that... what I'm thinking about a lot is that maybe after this crisis is over, that a lot of people will actually also have like something like a PTSD moment.
Oh, 100%.
6 months later, kind of.
Mass. Look, everyone is going to know someone who died and who died terribly.
Yeah.
Who died alone in a hospital. I mean, that is the thing that's killing me so much is the lonely death. that's not a feature of human existence. We don't let people generally die by themselves. We care for them through their death as best we can. Our family members, the people we love, and they are going to die by themselves in a room. That's what terrifies me. And that trauma is going to live with us as a, on an international scale. And we know for a fact that MDMA is incredibly useful, that's ecstasy, in treating intractable PTSD that has not responded to other treatment. We've done studies. We know this.
Mm-hmm. MAPS does a lot of that.
If we're going to take that tool out of our arsenal, we're going to keep ourselves from having everything we need to help people recover from this.
But do you think this will also lead to a, let's say, like a political push towards a quicker decriminalization with these things?
I don't know what's going to happen in America. You know, I think this is going to mean, even though it's Trump's fault we don't have personal protective equipment, it's Trump's fault we don't have, we were unprepared on a national scale. It's Trump's fault that more people are dying. It's Trump's fault that we don't have ventilators. All of that is directly at the feet of this cretinous, despicable, vile, fascist president, and he's going to be reelected, 100%.
Do you think?
His approval ratings have never been so high. I don't even know what to say. So I don't know what's going to happen in this country. I think this country, he's going to be empowered to destroy it in a way, even more than he already has. Angela Merkel is incredible, and she's what a leader needs to be. And you
think so too?
I get inspired. I'm like, I listen to her, not to fucking Donald Trump. So I think that hopefully this will inspire a change and a movement in a better direction. And I do think psychedelics can be part of that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's this new, not new expression, but this kind of term that's kind of developing now, like, which you could describe as a new mental wellness that is needed. Mental health. Most people would go like, whoa, now what's the famous Jack Nicholson movie? Somebody flew over the cuckoo nest.
Oh, yeah.
So most people.
We do have this bias against. Look, we have a tremendous bias against, you know, it's interesting. That movie is about, you know, the evils of electrotherapy, which we call electroshock, you know. And now that therapy, not in the way it was then, not without anesthesia, not in those huge doses, but that proves incredibly effective to people. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to me, like, these more these therapies that have been dismissed as out there have actually proven more effective than these pharmaceutical, incredibly lucrative, profitable pharmaceutical remedies.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I'm such a pessimist deeply in my soul that it almost hurts me to say that maybe the world is moving in this small area in the right direction. But if, And by the way, the kind of optimism and sense of hope that I also did a large psilocybin experience after the book came out. And there was a period where I was able to access that optimism. The election of Donald Trump has kind of cured me of that. So, but, you know, it's still there in my heart. And if I let that optimistic flower bloom, I might be more willing to say what you say, which is that we're on the road to a better place on these issues.
Well, I mean, I think it feels almost like there's no other option anymore, because a little bit of yoga won't help after this. No. Or like going to a spa once in a while.
And you can put as many crystals in your vagina as you want. It's not
going to
make you... No. Yeah, it's not going to bring you to a place of mental. I mean, maybe if you put the crystals in vagina and you make $1 billion marketing those crystals, you can afford to get to a place of mental health. But
yeah, probably not.
I don't know, man.
But
and weirdly, talking about talking about crystals in your vagina, the mainstreaming of psychedelic experience. I mean, look at that Goop. Goop,
the show,
did their psychedelic episode, which was pretty freaking amazing when you think
about absolutely.
It.
I mean, I thought a lot of people I know told me after seeing this, okay, now I really understand what this is, and I understand
so
that it's great.
Kind of,
yeah, kind of.
I mean, really,
absolutely.
Seriously.
Like, no, I mean, I thought it was a great
like
show.
That happens is really helpful to the cause.
Yeah. But I mean, I find it very interesting that if you watch your talks and a book, that you're really very open about this, although you're not like an activist, a psychedelic activist, although maybe now you are, maybe in a weird way. But I mean, I find it interesting what is the main reaction from people? I mean, now in the Bay Area, of course, everybody has heard about LSD forever.
Across the country, I've gotten support in like most incredible places.
Okay.
Like South Dakota, like,
okay.
I mean, Iowa. I mean, seriously, you would not believe, like, going, look, when you go to a city like Sioux City or something, every single person inclined to be of this state of mind comes to see you. So you have a huge audience, like 300, 400,
sure.
Unbelievable. But that's like every single person in that city, you know, who, like when you go to New York, you might have the same size audience, but most of the people who agree with you just don't bother to show up.
Mm-hmm.
But they're so starved for connection in these more red state places. But there they are, older people, younger people, you know, librarians and hipsters
all together.
Together. There may only be a few of them in that city, but they're there.
So, I mean, and did they, what was their main question? How can I do this? What do I have to do?
Everybody's main question is, can you get me up at LSD? Like, you know, it's so interesting.
It's so cool.
Ask that question, ask it really openly.
Yeah.
Can you, Ayala, buy me illegal drugs? Or give me illegal drugs? They ask it super openly, even though it's a crime. The people who are secretive and the people who are ashamed are the people who come up to me after an event and take me aside and say, I'm depressed. I'm suicidal. I don't know what to do. Those people can't talk about their experience. Those people are ashamed because we are so deeply in our society invested in not loving, not caring for the people who we need to care for and love. And it's really telling to me that those are the people who feel the need to hide their despair. But the people who are like the committing crimes are like, woohoo, get me my drugs, I got that. So it really is, it's a terrible indictment of the state of mind and the state of politics and the state of criminal justice in this country.
But I mean, how do
I bet it's true in Germany too.
Yeah.
I bet it's true that the people who feel depression, the people who feel weakened, the people who feel at risk are also ashamed.
Yeah, absolutely. Totally. I mean, I think the shame aspect will now maybe also with this kind of disappear because everybody has had a similar experience. I mean, even if you're very wealthy, you can have people die in your...
Exactly. This is the great
surrounding.
Equalizer. This disease is
equalizer. Exactly.
I, unfortunately, exposure did not equalize the American individual who most needed to be equalized. But there, what I've heard, and I don't know if this is true, is that you won't die, but you will know someone who died, and
yeah,
you'll
or
have
like
someone close to you who died,
yeah, or is who was in a very weird condition at least for a while or something.
And there's going to be long term damage. People are going to experience long term damage to their lungs, and their lives will be shortened. And so that collective trauma is equalizing, and maybe that will inspire us to care for one another in a way that we have not before.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
But I mean, in what way do you think this whole, let's say your the beginning of your psychedelic life, how would you say it will or has it already changed your writing?
Well, first of all, on the very practical basis, it made me incredibly productive.
Okay.
Like, it's a little
that's
bit
good.
Like Adderall and Zoloft combined, microdosing, like, or what they say Adderall and Zoloft are supposed to do, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then I hope that I'm more reflective. Like, right, you know, I haven't written a novel since that experience. And I do think that before, if I turn to another novel, right now I'm focusing on television, which I really, really love. But I'm hoping that before I write a novel, I will have an opportunity to do another one of these psilocybin experiences, because I know that that cracks open my head, and I know that that brings me to a place of greater understanding and insight into the connectivity of the human experience and the natural experience. And I want to be able to write from that place. So I think it's going to make me a better writer. I hope it makes me a better
writer. Well, I mean, I think that that's what a lot of people say. We had that in the last podcast also. You see, first of all, you see a lot of comic characters. It's like a very specific Disney movie, or like Disney related. And I saw like Peter Pan the whole time. Like, I mean, basically, not Peter Pan. What's her name? Tinkerbell. So,
yeah.
And so it's interesting how a lot of people see like childlike characters. So, and I mean, this brings them to ideas, like a lot of ideas.
My psilocybin experience was very challenging. It was not, like, the first thing I said when I was sort of back to myself was, why the fuck would anybody do this for fun? It was very hard.
Okay.
It, first of all, I was terribly ill. I had, like, I was vomiting, and my subjective experience was that I was vomiting black rats, you know.
Wow.
See that, like, and I felt them. I saw them. They came out. Not Tinkerbell. Black rats.
And, okay, good.
Yeah. And then I kind of, I experienced the fracturing of my ego and superego, so that in the end I was holding them in my hands and felt and was confident that I would never be sane again. That was very hard. But then there were amazing pieces of it. Like, you know, there were fun pieces of it. Like, I was integrated in dancing with the Black Stone Goddess.
Wow, that sounds good.
Yeah. The woman who led my experience trained in Mexico, and she was very excited about that piece. She said that's the Aztec goddess. I was less interested in that piece because all that piece was like physically like exciting, and it wasn't a time of terrible insight for me. But then I really had tremendous insight into my relationship with my daughter that has profoundly changed it permanently. And then I also had a feeling of the deepest gratitude I ever experienced in my life, access to the true meaning of gratitude. And the insight into my relationship with Sophie has sustained, but no Tinkerbell.
Well, I
Blackstone
mean,
goddess
well, okay, wait, rats. I didn't tell you the whole story. Tinkerbell in a concentration camp.
Oh,
4 hours.
You came up with your own black rats.
Exactly. So I was just saying, it wasn't Tinkerbell being Tinkerbell. It was, I mean, it was really like, I was at a camp and rabbis talked to me what they were thinking of me and what we should do together in the future.
That's so fascinating. I wonder how many, because it's like you're having insight into your place in the world. I wonder how, if you did a study, how many people of German heritage would have that, because I know two
who saw
because I know Holocaust survivors whose lives have been completely changed by this experience, and they're able to like overcome the guilt of survival and understand and see their dead parents for the last time in a way that has made them able to heal. So it
was it George Salo maybe that,
yeah. So George, who's a friend of mine. But others, I've heard others who have talked about that too. And going back to the 60s, using psychedelics try to heal the Holocaust. So, you know, somebody should do a study of a group psilocybin experience.
But also should somebody do a study, I feel, about the Germans whose obviously grandparents, like my grandparents, father were in the war, or were actually obviously Nazis in a way. And so I feel that the people who did this to Jewish people have also a similar PTSD situation, because they could not deal with it. Just can't.
The legacy of guilt is very real.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very real and it's a heavy burden.
But I mean,
I think we just came up with our like joint study. Well, that we're going to be talking more.
Yes, and let's give us, because we have 5 minutes to 4 minutes. Let's give us three or four really great advice besides building a company around this whole thing that what you're doing to kind of go through this time.
Survive.
Your top five,
okay,
top three.
So the first thing I have to say is reach out to community any way you can. Mm-hmm. Do video chats with your family and your friends. Have a book club online. Reach out so that you don't feel alone, so that you connect. This FaceTime is a means of connection. Use that technology.
Sure.
That's my first advice. My second advice is do something useful. Even if it's only donate money, do something useful that makes you feel mm-hmm. part of the greater human family.
Mm-hmm.
Third, read. You can immerse yourself in a book and you can be gone in it for hours.
Yep.
And my last piece of advice is when you choose your media, lots of people are watching Netflix, choose it carefully. Choose things that will feed your soul. They don't have to be cheerful. But choose things that will feed your soul rather than just crap.
Yeah, that's the best idea, actually, I think. And so, for example, the Bill Gates documentation on Netflix, I find very interesting.
So we as a family are together watching this crazy documentary called Tiger King.
Okay.
And it's amazing because we're seeing this part of America that we didn't know existed. And we're learning and we have like...
Cool.
Astonishment and compassion for all these people, which is so good. It's actually Tiger King is feeding our soul right now.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.